The Mississippi River has been dredged, shaped, and shackled. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we'll travel back to a time before the river was tamed. Lee Sandlin is author of Wicked River, the Mississippi, When It Last Ran Wild. He'll be here along with Jerry Ensler, executive director of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. We'll find out what the Mississippi River was like before the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers made it safe, when a trip down the river was often deadly and a trip back up was nearly impossible. The people who lived along the shores and on the water were nearly as wild as the river itself. We'll find out about pirates at the Crow's Nest, the wildlife of transient towns that formed each night on the water, and the legends that live on. Please join our conversation after the news. This is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we are exploring the history of the mighty Mississippi. Although it's still impressive, the river of today bears little resemblance to the river as it was designed by nature. My guests today are Lee Sandlin. He's author of Wicked River, The Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. Hello, Lee.
How you doing?
Very good. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Also with us today is Jerry Ensler, executive director of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque. Hello, Jerry.
Well, hello, Charity.
Thanks a lot for being here.
Sure, my pleasure.
Lee, let's start with you. And I think it's impossible for most of us to think about the Mississippi River without thinking about Mark Twain and
sure.
The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. But you write that by the time that book was written, the river had been tamed and Mark Twain was really writing its eulogy.
He really was. What most people don't realize about Twain is that when he started writing about the Mississippi with Adventures of Tom Sawyer in the 1870s. He actually hadn't been on the river in almost 20 years. He made one trip back while he was writing Huckleberry Finn, and he was amazed and appalled to find how much it had changed since he'd known it. His books are really portraits of the river the way it was in his childhood before the Civil War.
Well, let's go back in time. And Jerry, I'll let you start us off with this, but I want you both to weigh in. The river, as it was designed by nature. Jerry, what was it like?
Oh, it was wild and untamed. It had a vast floodplain. The river, a natural river, likes to have periods of drought where you can't navigate boats, and then it likes to have periods where it really spreads out. It can go double, triple, quadruple its size almost every year. And then when civilization comes along, they say, well, let's put levees here to stop it from flooding, and let's put dams in to raise the water level. So it was far, far different than what it is now. This is actually one of the premises of our museum is that the Mississippi River is almost a human-made artifact, and that's our biggest artifact that we interpret at the museum.
Well, and it's certainly one of the premises of your book as well, Lee.
Yeah.
Describe for us a little bit about the yearly cycle on the river. What was it like to live along the shore?
Well, the major event each spring was that when the meltwater would start pouring into the tributaries of the north, the river would start to rise, and by about June, it had flooded. It flooded essentially every year, and there was no way of telling in any given year how bad the flood was going to be. This is before telegraphs and before there was any transportation along the river, so you just waited each year to find out how much the river would flood. And it could be just a few feet, or it could be this enormous catastrophe. You never knew. And then in the summer, it would gradually, the river would tend to fall. It was usually at its lowest ebb in the late summer. And then it would rise again in the fall, and then it would freeze over. The upper river would freeze over during the winter.
You have a wonderful story in your book that was told by a man named Thomas Bangs Thorpe about his experience of being on the shore of the river in a terrible storm. Can you describe what he described?
Well, it was the sort of thing that happened to people all the time along the river because the river was so large that what in an ordinary river would be like little tiny variations in its run would be lead to enormous changes in the Mississippi itself. And Thorpe was just traveling, he was hunting along the riverbank and got caught in a fearsome thunderstorm. And he and his companions found a cabin. It was sitting empty, and they just hid out in the cabin along the riverbank. And midway during the night, the river shifted, and the bank and the cabin and almost Thorpe and his party almost all went straight into the river. And that was the sort of thing that could happen any particular day. There were instances where people, because the river ran between states, one of which would be, was a free state and one of which was a slave state, the river could change course, and somebody who had a plantation in a slave state could find that overnight his plantation had been moved into a free state and all of his slaves were now free.
Jerry, when the river was as nature intended, what would you see if you traveled down the river? What would you see along the shores?
Well, you'd see a lot of muddy sloughs. In fact, the earliest steamboats, they had two clerks. They had the regular clerk who stayed inside, and then they had a junior clerk who was called the mud clerk, and he tromped through the mud because everywhere a steamboat stopped, this clerk had to go out through the mud and, you know, count the cargo being unloaded, whether it was apples or iron or whatever, and help passengers on board. You would have seen a lot more trees and forests. We deforested many of the banks of the Mississippi, not only to build our homes and towns and buildings, but also to provide wood for the boilers for the steamboats. But there are still vestiges of areas, especially in Iowa and Illinois. Much of the area along the river is part of the National Mississippi Wildlife and Fish Refuge. And at the lower area, just north of Alakon Dam, it's a greatly changed river. But just south of Alakon Dam, you'll find somewhat close to a more natural river, a lot of braided islands and sloughs and backwaters, and it was very rich and diverse, and it still is a very rich and diverse river.
Before the steamboats came, Lee, what kinds of boats were people using to navigate on the river?
Oh, they had every kind imaginable. The basic boat was called the flatboat, and it was essentially just a sort of wooden box made with wooden nails and screws, actually, because they were cheaper than iron, say, if you imagine something about 10 or 12 feet wide and 20 or 30 feet long, just this completely, this rectangle floating on the water, you've got it pictured pretty exactly. The advantage it had is it had a very shallow draw, so they could load it up with cargo and take it over the sandbars. But they had all kinds of things. There were keel boats. There were pirogues, which were hollowed out logs. There were Indian birch bark canoes. There were rafts. There were barges. There's this enormous amount of traffic coming down the river, mostly in the spring. There'd be hundreds and hundreds of boats coming down the river every spring.
When you describe all the dangers of the river, it seems crazy to me that people would set out in these boats that had just been screwed together. Why did they do that?
Well, for money, mostly. The river was actually the only way of getting anything downstream. There were no highways, there were no roads, and this was before railroads. So the river was it. If you were going to travel to take your goods to the market, the only way to travel was that way. And because of the isolation of the interior of the country, the major market was in New Orleans. And so that was the natural goal. And also, that was the easiest way to go. If you just got a boat onto the river, the current would carry you there.
What were the dangers that they needed to, once they got on these boats, what were the dangers in the water that they needed to be looking out for?
Well, the major danger were the fallen trees. Because the river was changing course constantly, trees along the riverbanks were falling into the river all the time, and there was nowhere for them to go. They would stay in the water, and they would sooner or later get impaled in the mud and would often be, and some of these trees were like 100 feet tall, would be sitting in the river, stuck in the river mud, and just almost barely reaching up to the surface of the water. And so you couldn't see them, but if you ran a boat over them, you would wreck immediately. They were called snags. It was kind of a bland term, but it was a major danger. I read one estimate that the Army Corps of Engineers found a major snag, I think, every 500 yards on the river.
When somebody set out in one of these boats, let's say from Iowa or Illinois, how long would it take them to get to New Orleans?
usually about 2 or 3 weeks, but then they'd be faced with the problem of getting back.
Right, that's my next question. Yeah. How did they get back?
Well, there were a lot of ways before steamboats came in, and the reason why steamboats took over the river so quickly is that they could go against the current. But before there were any boats to go against the current, they used every way imaginable. They'd raise oars, they'd row, they'd do this thing called bushwhacking, where they would just, the crew would be hugging the riverbank, and they would just grab branches and bushes along the shore and pull their boat forward with their hands. They did this thing called cordelling, where they would go ashore with a rope and drag the boat forward. But often what they would do is they would sell their boat once they got to New Orleans, and they would walk back home. They would actually just walk on foot, mile by mile, day after day, and it would take them months or sometimes the better part of a year to get back home.
But faster than trying to get back up by boat.
Yeah, well, it was easier. It was more dangerous, of course, because the riverbanks were dangerous and there were no trails and there were a lot of danger. There were a lot of threats, but yeah, that was often the only way of getting back home.
You describe another way of getting up the river by boat where people would use poles to move themselves along the river. Describe how that worked.
Well, what they would do is that they would the crew would line up along one side of the boat, and they would have these poles that they built for this. There were these long wooden poles with metal tips, and they would implant the poles into the river mud, and then they would walk towards the stern of the boat, and that movement would, you know, holding onto their poles, would push the boat forward under their feet. And as they moved forward, each one, the head of the row, would snatch his pole out of the water, run to the back of the row, and plant it there. It was a very strange sight. But that was often the only way that they could get a boat to move forward.
Right, and that couldn't have always worked because the river was so deep in places.
Often it didn't, yeah, because the river was deep, or they couldn't get a foothold into the mud, or there'd be a slide or something that had taken out the shore, and so there was nothing for them to push against. It was a major task getting a boat up against the current.
When I was reading about that, I just imagined how cold and demoralizing those journeys must have been.
It was not a very easy way of life at all. It was in no sense a romantic way of life.
Well, we will talk more about life on the river and life next to the river and the life within the river coming up in just a moment. My guests today are Lee Sandlin, he's author of Wicked River, The Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild, and Jerry Ensler, executive director of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque. You're welcome to join us with your memories of the river, your questions as well, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. The sky was clear on that windy day till the clear blue sky began to turn to gray. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guests today are Jerry Ensler, he's executive director of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque, and Lee Sandlin, who is author of Wicked River, The Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. And I want to talk about the civilization along the shores of the Mississippi. And Jerry, let's talk about the earliest civilization that we know at least a little bit about along the shores of the Mississippi, and those would be the mound builders. What do we know about them?
Well, actually, the mound builders are maybe 600 to 700 years, and there's been far earlier records or, you know, archaeological finds. But the mound builders are the first ones where we have a significant evidence of building large cities. Now, there are mounds like effigy mounds in Iowa near McGregor Marquette. There was certainly a civilization around that. One of the largest was Cahokia Mounds, and that was a very large city. I think we're talking about approximately 700 or 800 to 1200 A.D. to 1300 A.D. And it was such a large city. There was trade, there was commerce. They selected this very, very wisely because they were at the junction of the Missouri and the Mississippi River, and the Illinois River was coming in just upstream. So they had a very intricate and complex community that, you know, the city of Chicago didn't surpass it in population probably until the late 19th century. So there were literally thousands of mound builders living at Cahokia and all up and down the Mississippi River.
Do we know what happened to them?
We don't really know. Some people conjecture that perhaps the Illinois Indians are somehow distantly related. The Illinois are the first group of Indians that Marquette and Joliet found when they traveled down the Mississippi in 1673. And there's some debate going on. Some people feel that they were found on the western shore, footprints, and then they Marquette and Joliet talked to them. It was either in northern Missouri or in southern Iowa where the Illinois were. But you know, this early region is, I mean, the Mississippi was well known. Well before George Washington was even born, the lead mines of Dubuque, Iowa were known, and they were marked on maps in France and in England as a mine de plomb, mines of lead. And it was easier to get to the Mississippi River by water across the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico and up the river than it was to go overland for people like Daniel Boone or later George Washington who wanted to visit the Mississippi. It was so much easier because of the water route.
Well, and there were stories told about the Mississippi. I mean, it wasn't just on maps, but it was a legend before many people were even here.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and many of the explorers, they were trying to find the great river of the West, and they thought the Mississippi would somehow lead them to that. But once they realized the Mississippi, you know, led south, they started to realize the magnificence of it. The Anishinaabe, we know them more commonly as the Ojibwe or Chippewa, they called it the great river, Mississippi, which is how it gets its name. There were tremendous stories. When Marquette and Joliet were paddling down the Mississippi, they were warned that there might be giant birds that would come and grab them with their talons and swoop them out of their canoes and take them away. And indeed, they did find, they had giant sturgeon that were ramming the side of their canoe that Marquette thought they were going to be capsized. And then they found at Alton, Illinois, these two paintings that were on the cliffs, on the bluffs, done by Native Americans. And that was a source of a lot of tales about the Mississippi as well.
Lee, let's talk about the early European settlement along the Mississippi. What were these early towns like?
Well, there were originally French and Spanish settlers along the Mississippi in the 17th and 18th centuries, and the Spanish, in fact, built a lot of what we think of as the French architecture. The French Quarter in New Orleans, for instance, was built by the Spanish. When the northern European settlers, the American settlers, came west, which was mostly after the Louisiana Purchase, they did not build classy towns like the Spanish did. They just built whatever they could with whatever was to hand. So almost all the towns along the Mississippi in the early 19th century were these really pretty squalid shanty towns built out of the local lumber with minimum sanitation, minimum of any kind of public service at all, no running water. I mean, people would just drink from the river. In fact, they went on drinking from the river until the early 20th century, which was way longer than they probably should have. These towns were European travelers who took steamboats up the Mississippi in the middle 19th century were pretty appalled at what the towns were all like. They were not, even though European cities were not models of cleanliness, they were still pretty appalled at what they found there.
Well, you write about it was a memoir, so he was writing about when he was a young man, his boyhood on the Mississippi, the memoir by George Byron Merrick, Old Times.
Yes.
On the Mississippi, on the Upper Mississippi.
Old Times on the Upper Mississippi,
right,
yeah.
And he grew up in Prescott, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
How did he describe life in the 1840s?
He actually loved it there. You know, for a boy growing up in the middle of the wilderness, it was a very sort of Tom Sawyerish life. Kids then weren't really supervised at all the way that they are now. Merrick and his friends would often go camping in the woods for a week without even telling their parents they were leaving, and nobody worried about them. The big excitement, as Mark Twain described too, was the arrivals of the steamboats. He was also living between two Indian settlements, and he and the Native American boys would go swimming and canoeing together. He thought it was a pretty idyllic way of life.
And you write that at that time, when boys in his town would reach a certain age, they would go.
They would go, yeah. Yeah, they would. The steamboats would come through, and, you know, these were these spectacular, luxurious constructions, very glamorous, and they would hire on for almost no money, and they would head off, and the people in the towns were usually pretty appalled by anybody who decided to make their living that way, and they had the saying, they would, you know, they'd be talking about some kid who used to hang out at the docks, and somebody would say, "What happened?" And they'd just say, "Gone on the river."
And that was it.
And that was it.
When people were traveling down the river, they didn't travel at night. At least most of them didn't travel at night. So tell me what they did to stay safe through the night.
Well, they didn't travel. This is before steamboats came in a huge way. They didn't travel through the night because it was just too dangerous. There were too many things that could go wrong. It was too easy for the boat to be capsized or to go aground or to be run over by one of the barges or rafts that did run all night because there was no way of maneuvering them into shore. So they would tend to cluster in groups for safety, and the place that they did it were usually the levees of the river towns. So these little temporary cities of boats would build up before the river town levees every night along the river, really from New Madrid in the north down pretty close to New Orleans. So that's what you would see each night along the river, these clusters of boats all lit up. They were all cooking and dancing, you know, having little impromptu parties. And that was, you know, the little river communities, how they would form.
And you wrote that these communities didn't travel down the river together. Once they spent the night together, basically these people would never see each other again.
Yeah, they would scatter because the river was so large and the currents were so unpredictable in a lot of ways that it was just too difficult to, you know, once you started down, if you met somebody at one port, the chances were slim to none you were going to meet them again at the next. So all these cities were just these very temporary overnight things.
And this sort of transient lifestyle led to some conflicts, not just among the people who were on the river together, but there were a lot of conflicts between the people on the river and the people on the shore.
Well, when you think about it, because there was no other way of travel than the river, and there was no way of getting messages down the river, perfect environment for thieves, because if you got something into your boat and took it down the river, you were gone. They were never going to be able to catch you. So the river people were notorious for, as they traveled down the river, adding to their cargo with anything they found on shore that they thought they could sell in New Orleans. And because of that, and because there was no law enforcement effectively along most of the river during the early 19th century, the only response the farmers would have is to put armed patrols up, and they would shoot at anybody who came ashore. And in the towns, you'd also have the problem that the river people, when they would gather there each night, would get drunk and come ashore and want to raise hell. And so at the towns, there were often armed patrols whose only job was keep the river people on their boats.
There were also pirates.
And there were pirates, yeah, because there again, a completely lawless environment. There were organized bands of pirates all along the river and up the Ohio as well that were preying on the river traffic. And they would take over these islets that, well, they're still there, of course, but these transient islets were continually forming along the river in those days. And they would set up camp there, and they would just, you know, set out to rob every boat that they saw coming down the river.
You have to tell the story about the Crow's Nest and the Great Shakes. It's so unbelievable to think about this happening so close to where we live. But tell us what happened.
Well, the Crow's Nest pirates were notorious for being the most violent and savage pirates on the river. That they would wantonly kill people on boats after they'd robbed them. And they were this... They were a pretty horrifying bunch of people, and the Crow's Nest was an islet in the lower valley that that they had taken over and turned into a sort of little pirate headquarters. And there had been one point, there was a story that, and I've never really quite been able to confirm this story, that at one point the river people banded together and stormed the island and killed everybody they found there. But they may have just been telling this as a way of cheering themselves up to say these guys weren't invincible. But it didn't seem to stick because the Crow's Nest pirates were flourishing again within a couple of years. Up until the winter of 1811-1812, one of the most extraordinary events that's ever natural disasters that's happened in America occurred, which was the New Madrid earthquakes, which were called on the river the Great Shakes.
And what were they like if you were on the river or living on the shores? What did people experience?
Well, the thing that everybody cited afterwards is that the last of the shakes was so violent it caused this backwash to flash back north up the river, so it literally looked as though the Mississippi was running backwards. And the quakes, which are the largest earthquakes ever recorded in North America, were so powerful that even though they were centered in lower Missouri, they rang church bells in Montreal. So you have an idea of how vast these quakes were. And they caused huge landslips. These catastrophic changes in the environment. Now, the thing was that their epicenter was in a part of the river that was very thinly scattered, so very few people on shore actually were hurt by them, but it occurred when there was a lot of traffic on the river and hundreds of boats were swamped and drowned, and nobody knows how many people were killed. But one of the things that happened as a result of this is when they started coming downriver again after the worst of the quakes were over, they approached the Crow's Nest pirates the way they always had, were preparing for the worst, and found that the island and the pirates were simply gone. They disappeared overnight without a trace. The floods coming down during the quakes had destroyed the island and killed everyone on it.
Well, of course, with all of the supernatural predictions about the earthquakes, there had been a comet that year, and I'm sure that was probably explained away with supernatural terms by a lot of people on the river.
Oh, yeah. Well, they thought it was, God's justice. There were a lot of people then were big believers in omens, and there had been, in the months leading up to the New Madrid quakes, an enormous comet, which had covered most of the sky by the time it disappeared, and everyone thought that was a horribly bad sign, although nobody knew what it was going to be.
Jerry, when I was reading Lee's book and reading about these natural disasters on the river, and this earthquake is just one of the many events that is described that, of course, killed a lot of people and changed the land and changed the river. We've all been through floods in Iowa, and we know that those are powerful. But what do you think we need to know about the Mississippi and the power of the Mississippi that probably we don't really recognize now?
Well, a lot of people underestimate the force of the river, the current. I live right on the Mississippi, and just maybe 500 yards from where I live, a few years ago, there was somebody having a little picnic on the island, and they backed up into the current of the river. They didn't think there was going to be much current there. The person couldn't swim, and he drowned. Going back, my family lived in Dubuque in the 1850s, and a little boy chased would have been my ancestors in my family. He chased his little dog. He was 4 years old and chased his dog into the river, and they both drowned. So the current of the river is tremendously powerful. What's in the water itself, from a chemical composition, is a little bit frightening. I mean, I still wade and swim in the river, but I certainly wouldn't drink from it. And we currently, as a nation, test for 100 chemicals a year. There are over 1,000 new chemicals that are introduced to our lifestyle every year. We have a saying at the museum, get your fish off Prozac. We've got fish who are on medication because they're getting it from our bodily fluids. So they're on antidepressants, they're on estrogen, they're on steroids. Our water systems are not really purifying for that. So the fish certainly are becoming contaminated by our human civilization, and our humans are too.
Do you feel like the floods have reminded people of what the river can be?
Oh, yes, I do indeed, and I think they're getting much more severe. I think the primary cause is the reduction of wetlands. Iowa is one of the most changed states in the Union in terms of the amount of land that we've converted to other use, other than, you know, the ability to absorb water. And so it's not just agriculture and levees and tiling, but it's shopping malls and parking lots and streets and the like. And we've had tremendous floods in the past 10 years. And I think we're all becoming a little bit more aware and a little bit leery of what's going to come. I mean, Cedar Rapids, the fact in 2008 that their flood stage was, you know, fully 10 feet higher than it had ever been in the past. And then the damage to Ames most recently, enormous damage there. And so I think we're in for some very severe floods that continue to happen, and it's not going to be just on the main channel of the Mississippi. When the Mississippi floods, it is absolutely enormous. I mean, even today, I mean, right now the river stage is 5 feet higher than it normally would be, and it's been high since September. And we're all kind of scratching our head thinking, how come the river is so high right now? What's going to happen?
We'll talk more about that in a moment. We're talking today about the history of the Mississippi River. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. My guests today are Jerry Ensler, he's executive director of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque, and Lee Sandlin, who is author of Wicked River, The Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. And Lee, I want to talk about some of the mythology of the Mississippi River.
Okay.
And I think that a wonderful example of the kind of mythology around the river are the stories about Mike Fink. Can you tell us who he was?
Mike Fink may or may not have been a real person, but he was sort of the Paul Bunyan of the Mississippi. And he was somebody that everybody on the river liked telling stories about. He was supposed to be the greatest of the keelboatmen. He was often the last of the keelboatmen. Stories about him, they're really kind of horrifying stories, because each one is, what they admired most about him is that he had this kind of resort to casual violence in any situation. He was the sort of person who would just pick up a gun and shoot it and hit a target perfectly, whether the target was a human being or a bird or a tree trunk. And the stories are all about how he would just travel down the river responding to whatever happened to him by the sudden act of violence, which they thought was, you know, basically a pretty admirable way of living.
So, was he a hero to most people?
He was. And people on the frontier in those days resorted to violence pretty casually, for very little provocation. And he sort of exemplified that tradition, in that he seems to have done it just out of sort of joie de vivre. But that seems indistinguishable when you're looking at it with modern eyes from being this sort of psychopath. But that was the kind of life they admired then. You know, it was a very violent, very casually violent world. And it was also, in a lot of ways, a very callous world. They kind of admired stories of violent death even more than we do today.
I found myself wondering if Mike Fink is actually the source for our use of the word Fink.
No, I don't think that's true. I wondered about that. But also, you know, a Fink is usually considered, you know, sort of disreputable, sneaky guy, and that was sort of the opposite of what Fink was.
Unless you read the stories, and it sounds like that's exactly what he was, but that's not how people felt about him. Right, okay.
He didn't keep secrets. He was just a pretty sort of brutal guy. But the name is interesting because it has so little poetry about it. I kind of thought that was a well-chosen name, because it's kind of an ugly name in a way, and it catches the very unromantic character of the river and who they thought were the heroes.
Well, yeah, it certainly doesn't have the the ring of Paul Bunyan.
No, it's not a resonant name.
Right, but there was...
And my apologies to people who actually are named Mike Fink. I know there's someone out there who actually is with that name, and I would hate to be insulting to them.
Speaking of frontier justice and violence, there is a term that came from life on the Mississippi, and that term is lynching, and that comes from the courts of Judge Lynch.
Yeah.
Tell us about the courts of Judge Lynch.
Well, the term actually isn't strictly from the Mississippi because it had started back east during the Revolutionary War, but the Mississippi sort of institutionalized it in a way that we might find surprising now. They didn't have a lot of faith in traditional justice then. And so most of the actual, criminal trials, anyone suspected of a crime would be put on trial before amateur courts, vigilante courts. And they were called the courts of Judge Lynch. And it was not a form of justice I think most of us would be very comfortable with. It has a bad reputation for a reason. We think of it now as something that usually whites are doing to people of color, but that actually didn't become the dominant meaning until after the Civil War. Before then, most of the people who ended up before these courts were white, and most of them were poor, and most of them got very direct and brutal forms of justice.
Well, you've certainly described some of those stories in your book, and I don't think we have time to go into them right now. But I also want to talk about another kind of mythology about the Mississippi. And this was, it was the Mississippi as a form of entertainment for people. People painted these incredible panoramas.
Yeah.
Describe what those were like.
Well, they were kind of an early form of a travelogue movie. They were done on these enormous rolls. Each roll was about 20 feet high and several hundred yards long, that would be painted with these landscape scenes of the Mississippi. And they were much too large to be shown at one time, and instead they would be shown on theaters. There'd be two spools at opposite ends of a stage, and this enormous canvas would be unrolled in front of an audience, and there'd be a narrator describing the scenes. There'd also be a piano player or sometimes even a small orchestra who would, and these scenes of the most dramatic events along the river would be, it would take about 2 hours to watch one of these things. And so people would get this tour of the river from upriver down to the delta.
And those panoramas traveled all over the place.
Yeah, they traveled all over America and through Europe. Somebody tried to take one through South America. People then in South America weren't that impressed.
They said, we have our own river.
Yeah, basically. We've got the Amazon. What's the Mississippi? That's nothing. And there were also panoramas on many other subjects. It was a popular form of entertainment in those days, but the Mississippi was this natural subject and was the most successful subject for panoramas.
And when you start off the book, in your introduction, you talk about all of the people who wrote about the Mississippi River before Mark Twain. And, of course, we do all think of Mark Twain as being the person who wrote about the Mississippi. Yes. But even he refers to many other books that were written.
There were this enormous library of books written about the Mississippi before the Civil War. And they are all gone. In fact, they were gone during Mark Twain's time. He says in Life on the Mississippi, he found it impossible to find these books. But there were travelers' tales, there were letters from settlers, there were memoirs, there were the reminiscences of gamblers and steamboat pilots. There was this enormous volume of stuff written about the Mississippi. People were fascinated by it as a subject.
Were you able to dig some of those out?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of them. There's a library in Chicago, the Newberry Library, that has a lot of them. But there's also an enormous number of them now archived at Google Books. And they're just open archives. They're public domain books. And they have hundreds of these things, many of which not only have not been reprinted since the early 19th century, I don't think they've been read since then. And so my book is based largely on those.
And the panoramas have been lost, though.
Oh, yeah. They were gone long ago. There is one piece, I didn't mention this in the book, but there is a piece not about the Mississippi River, but there was a surviving panorama, a few fragments of one, of scenes in the Mississippi Valley that I believe a museum in Ohio might still have. But, they were painting it on very cheap canvas with very, very flammable oil paint. So they weren't really designed to last.
Jerry, do you have a collection of people's artifacts of any of these things about the Mississippi River? Have people brought you artifacts that they've found in their homes?
Well, we do. We have a tremendous collection. And one of the exhibits we created, although the panoramas themselves are lost, the images from Henry Lewis's panorama of the 1850s have survived. And so we put those together in an audiovisual presentation with a spin browser. So you can spin your way down the Mississippi River, seeing these historic images, which were blown up to tremendous size, as Lee was so wonderfully telling us about. But we have, there was a great collection of, there was a lot of art on board the steamboats. And, for example, the steamboat Natchez was captained by Thomas Leathers. He had a great affinity for Native Americans, and so he had paintings of Native Americans on his boat, the Natchez. And we just acquired two paintings on glass of Indians that were used as clear stories or, you know, transom windows on the steamboat Natchez, and they both show Native American scenes, and we just put those on display. So we get some extraordinarily valuable pieces like that, and we get letters and anchors and capstans and remnants, and there are very few pieces, hardly anything from the flatboat or the keelboat era, and very little from the early steamboat era, but we probably have the largest collection on the Mississippi River of that material.
I think we really have romanticized that steamboat era, and I was surprised to learn how brief it was. The steamboats weren't really on the river for that long.
Well, in their heyday, correct. I mean, their heyday, they came in 1812, but they didn't really become extraordinarily popular until the 40s. In the 30s, they were quite dangerous. The steamer Dubuque blew up around Muscatine, and 30 to 40 people were killed in that accident. By the 1850s, the steamboats became safe. By the 1880s, the railroad was replacing them. So you're right, it was a very short period compared to certainly the canoe period, the flatboat. And even when steamboats were being used, keelboats were also being used.
Well, and you say that they became safe, although, Lee, reading your book, I'm not sure I would agree with that. You
well,
write about some
safer,
pretty,
I should
right.
say, by the 1850s. So we'll see, they passed the Steamboat Inspection Act, I believe, 1851. Prior to that point, there really weren't many provisions for safety, but they still had these tremendous accidents. Average life was less than 5 years of a steamboat.
They were extremely safely designed by the 1850s, and Jerry's right about that. The problem is that they were used extremely recklessly, especially when the railroads started coming in. The steamboat captains were encouraged to speed up to try and compete with them, so they were running a full throttle the whole time. And also, the steamboat boilers were designed to run on clear water, not on Mississippi mud, and nobody really bothered to filter the waters, which led to a lot of explosions. It was a very, they were really beautiful pieces of construction by the end, but operated in a pretty reckless way.
Well, and you write that although they were very beautiful, and if you got into one of the cabins, they were opulent and lovely, people also said it wasn't so nice.
That was the common complaint the Europeans travelers had, was that the Americans had absolutely no manners. And I don't know whether they were exaggerating for comic effect or not, but there were many accounts of, they would lay on these spectacular banquets on these steamboats at each meal. And according to Francis Trollope, for instance, the mother of Anthony Trollope, the British novelist, this sort of horde of locusts of the American tourists would just descend on these banquets, devour them without a word, and split from the table in 15 minutes. And she was used to a much more civilized style of dining.
So there are so many stories we could talk about, but we're nearly out of time. So let's talk about the end of this era. The Mississippi, of course, played a very important role in the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, the Mississippi was tamed. What happened?
Well, you had several factors. The main factor, as far as the traffic goes, was that the railroads came in, and once people could ship goods or travel themselves by railroad, there really wasn't any real need to use the Mississippi at all. But the other factor is that that after the Civil War, the federal government began doing large-scale projects, which they hadn't really that hadn't been a popular thing for the government to be doing before the Civil War. But and one of the major public works projects of those years was to try and solve the flooding problem in the Mississippi. And that was when the Army Corps of Engineers began building much more elaborate levees and dams and jetties on the river. And that is when the it started becoming, as Jerry said earlier, this essentially artificial creation.
What do you want people to know about the Mississippi, Lee?
Well, in terms of my book, that there was this fascinating world that we don't really know about that grew up around the river, that hence it was a very strange and colorful and very sort of alluring world. And so just in terms of what I'm trying to entertain people in a lot of ways with that. But I'd also like people to think about the way that we use land and the way that we occupy land in America, because one of the things that came through to me when I was researching the book is that we remade the Mississippi in a very ad hoc way without really thinking through what was going to happen. And that's, we're still doing that with these large-scale, deliberate or not, remakings of our physical environment. We do it in this way without really considering what it's going to look like to successive generations. And it would be nice if people took away from the book a sense that, you know, what happened in the Mississippi didn't need to happen as catastrophically as it did. I really have a lot of doubts about how ecologically viable the river is now, even after all these attempts to clean it up. And it would be nice if people were a little more aware of that.
Jerry, what about you? What do you most want people to know about the Mississippi River today?
I really would like them to value its heritage, and Lee's done an extraordinary job of pulling that together in a very entertaining and compelling way. We'd also like them to know that that is part of their heritage. We surveyed over 1,000 people on all 10 states of the Mississippi. We found they were interested in the river, but they were not passionate about the river. We want them to be passionate. You know, 18 million people get their drinking water directly from the Mississippi River. It's purified, but it doesn't come from a well. So we want them to know that this is part of our heritage. It's part of our habitat, not only animal habitat, but human habitat. And we have to be a little bit more thoughtful about protecting it and utilizing it not only for commerce, but for conservation.
Jerry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Jerry Ensler is Executive Director of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque. And Lee, thank you for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
Lee Sandlin is author of Wicked River, The Mississippi When It Last Ran Wild. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today came from Mitchell Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. And, of course, you can send us email anytime. We'd love to hear your comments if you have any questions or suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Swamps all around make you feel kind of funny, don't they?